Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money. And hold that money. And practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march or demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches, they never change anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I've signed and I've stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
Like, you could just see
$600,000 deducted.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor." Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. Mm-hmm. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out to Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government, plus I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. Mm. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back.
Hey, everyone. Sam Ovens here. And today I have Danielle Leslie on with us. And Danielle's got an awesome story. And she started...
Well, you're about to discover, maybe for the first time in your life, that wealth is not money, and money's not wealth. Real estate's not wealth either. Neither is gold or silver. What is wealth? I believe that wealth is one thing. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. That's what wealth is. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. And so the more we develop our ability to create value for other people, the more wealthy we are. And the reason I say money's not wealth, think about it like this. If you were stuck on a desert island and you had hundreds of millions of dollars in cash, what would it be worth? Nothing. Right? If you're stranded there, nobody knows you're there, nobody can find you, all that money doesn't do you any good. If you're there with another person, and they have food, and you have water, and they have no water, and you have no food, then your water becomes your wealth because you can trade them some of your water for some of your food. Are y'all tracking? And so everything that we desire, we get by giving somebody else something they desire. The more value we create for other people, the more wealth we have. It's just that simple. Now, money is one of the stores of value. That's what money is. Money is a store of value, and it's also a way to transfer value. It's also a way to represent value that you've already created, right? So if you think about money as like a certification, right? Like it's a certificate that proves that you've created value for someone other than yourself. Right? And so, like, if you go to Eddie V's and you're a nice person, right, and you say, well, I would like for y'all to serve me some food, they are going to say, okay, we'll serve you some food, but at the end, they expect you to produce proof that you serve somebody other than you, and that proof shows up in the way of money, right? Because that's all money does. Money shows people that you deserve to have somebody create value for you because you can prove you created value for someone else, right? And here's what's really cool. All of us are good at different things. So we all have different value that we can create for other people. And if we keep the value that we create to ourselves, it doesn't really do us that much good. But if we spread the value, the value that we create for other people, if we spread that around, then it becomes more valuable. Now, here's what's really interesting. I can't create value for someone until I know what's valuable to that someone. So wealth creation has like a lot to do with discovery, like discovering what other people value. And if I'm going to know what other people value, then I got to know where do those values come from? Like, where do values come from? There are things you value that I don't value. There are things I value that you don't value, right? And there's things that we both value, but you might value more than me or I might value more than you. Huh. So where do our values come from? Okay, I believe the first place that values come from is past, perceived, I'm just going to do PERC, perceived voids create present pursued values. Are y'all tracking? Past perceived voids create present pursued values. What does that mean? That means if I feel like something was missing in the past, I will work in the present to fill the void that I had in the past, right? So that's why if people grow up in a place where they're in like dire hunger conditions or feast or famine, they value food like at a very high level, right? That's why people who, so for me, like, I like cars. I like them. I like cars. I grew up working on cars, right? But I grew up in a family where when I was growing up, my parents never bought a new car ever. They had seven boys. Here's what boys do. They eat you out of house and home, right? Boys can just, it's like they're a bottomless food pit, right? And I can remember, like, if I was in elementary school, if I was going to eat a sandwich, I wouldn't eat a sandwich. I'd eat two, three, or four sandwiches, right? But I like cars. And so we grew up with buying $50 cars, $100 cars, and then working on them and driving them until they broke down. Then we go buy another $50 car, $100 car, and we had no car payments, right? So I like cars. I used to see people with nice cars. I'm like, why do they have nice cars? We don't have nice cars, right? So that's a past perceived void in my life, right? So it became a present pursued value. Some people like, why do you have all these expensive cars? Well, expensive is a relative term anyway. I don't even, like, that's really relative. Like, it depends on, like, what is expensive to you, right? So, but the reason I, like, have a collection of, I say a collection, I've got some very nice cars is because I like cars, because that was, for me, a past perceived void. I work out. Why do I work out? Because in the past, I've been out of shape. And in the past, my body hurt. The more out of shape I was, the more my body hurt. So that's a past perceived void that created a present pursued value. Are y'all tracking? And so a lot of times we don't even know where these things that we value came from, right? I value entrepreneurship. Why? Because in the past I used to have jobs, and they always came with a boss. And I don't know. The word boss means, like, they're going to be bossing me around. That's what, like, they're going to tell me, like, can I go? No. And I can't even finish the question, right? Can I have? No. And I don't like to have to ask for permission. I don't like permission. In fact, the best way to get me to do something is to tell me I can't do it. I'm that dude, okay? I know none of you entrepreneurs are that way, right? So you started business because you love people telling you what to do. Okay, judgment-free zone. And so I like autonomy. My parents, great parents, they weren't perfect parents by any stretch of imagination, which is why I did not become a perfect parent. Okay, so but they were great parents for me and my brothers, right? And they were very authoritarian. Like it didn't matter if I was 7 or 17. Why? The answer was always going to be the same, because I said so. Right. So I liked autonomy. So when I wasn't at home, I didn't like teachers telling me what to do at school. I didn't like my parents telling me what to do at home. And then I got a job, and the boss wanted to tell me, and everybody wanted to tell me what to do. And I know it's my own little weirdness going on in my mind palace, but, like, you got yours, I got mine, and I don't like people telling me what to do. So I want to live as autonomous. Now, I want God to tell me what to do, but I don't like humans bossing me around, okay, because their motive is suspect. God's motive is not suspect, right? Right? And that's why I don't like it when people on my team call me, oh, this is my boss. I'm not your boss. I don't even like the word boss. I don't have an outfit that matches a boss. You don't have an outfit that matches a boss. So unless we're talking about business optimization success secrets from Boss Moves, then again, that's a different story. But not bossing people around. Anyway, so y'all get it. Past perceived voids create present pursued values. But also, the second place values come from, is present, pursued, I don't think I spelled that right, pursued victories create present pursued values. So present pursued victories, the things I'm working towards winning right now, will cause me to value that thing. And so I've got to value. I want to win. So because I want to win, okay, for instance, I'm going to put my son-in-law on blast. So my son-in-law, I mean, we're really, really close until we get on the golf course, and then we try to beat each other's brains out. It's great. Okay? So he wants to beat me really, really bad. I want to beat him really, really bad. And for a while, I just beat him all the time. And then, like, I lost my mojo, and then he beat me all the time, and he was sending his mom text messages like, there's a new sheriff in town, and then his mom would call me, and I'm like, is this really happening? Okay, cool. So I started working on my short game again, and so now it's like the last three tournaments we've had, we play three-round tournaments, and we have this trophy, and every time you win three rounds, you get to put your name on the trophy. No, it's not on the news, it's not on ESPN, nobody knows but us, but we relish this victory so much, right? And so what we do, because we both want to win, is we both spend time working on our game, because present pursued victories create present values. So the things that we felt like we're missing in the past, that creates value for us. The things that we're working on winning in the present, and then the last one, is future. Future. Pursued. I think I spelled that right. I don't know. Pursued visions create present perceived values. So what does that mean? That means I can see an outcome down the road that is worth sacrificing right now for, so I'll sacrifice the short term on the altar of the long term. I'll sacrifice, like, my pleasure right now because I've got this vision down the road, and I'll take some time off of playing golf, and I'll take some time off of practicing my guitar. I'll take some time off from something I want to do for me. Like, okay, give you for instance. I am a foodie. If I wanted to, I could easily weigh 400, 500, 600 pounds. It would be easy. Like, I like food. You say, what kind of food? Almost all kinds. I mean, I don't like pork, and I don't like shrimp, and I don't like yucky stuff. It's disgusting. But I like to eat. And the better it is, the more of it I like to eat. I'm just keeping it real. Like, brother man can throw it down. I can fling it down. Hear me when I tell you. I mean, where are my foodies? Where are my foodies? Okay? But because I have this future vision, right? Like, I've got this future vision. I've got a granddaughter. She's 3. One of the highlights of my life, my entire existence on this planet as a human, was when I got to dance with my daughter at her wedding. That was a highlight for me. Okay? So, one of my future visions that I have is to dance with my granddaughter, not at her wedding. My 3-year-old granddaughter. She's not going to get married at 3. That's not what I mean. Like, my granddaughter who is 3, when she becomes an adult, one of my objectives is to dance with her at her wedding. Well, let's say she gets married when she's 21, like my daughter did. Okay? She'll be 4 in July. So that gives me 17 more years. Well, in 17 years, I'll be 79, right? You know what that tells me? That tells me, as much as I love food, and I do love it, I don't like it, y'all. Hear me when I tell you. If I'm going to eat something, I want it to taste. I don't even want to waste any time eating food that don't taste good. Okay, y'all tracking? It's like, I'm the guy who, when I make spaghetti, I season the water I boil my noodles in. I'm that dude. Okay, how many of y'all tracking? Okay, now y'all know who y'all dealing with. Okay, so, just keeping it real. Okay, so, but because I want to dance with my granddaughter at her wedding when she gets married, I don't eat food until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I drink water in the morning, and I have a window to eat between 1 p.m. and 9 p.m. It opens at 1 with a protein shake, then I'll eat some snacks in between, like some carrot chips or some celery or something good with some different whatever dip I decide. I'll mix some honey mustard and some ranch, and I know that's not healthy. I don't really care. This is my vision, y'all. You do you. I'm going to do me. Okay, I know that's not the healthiest thing in the world, but it's what I do right now. So if y'all want me to do better, pray for me. Okay, so. And then I'll eat dinner. So that's, but I'm going to make sure my protein shake is really, really good. And I'm going to make sure my snacks are really, really good. And I'm going to make sure when I eat dinner, oh, look at him, is really, really good. Okay, so what am I telling you? I'm telling you my value comes from something that I desire that's way in the future, that I'm willing to sacrifice right now on, right? It's too many people, they don't understand that today is yesterday's tomorrow. And they act as if the actions they take today have no consequences in the future, right? And so the definition of sacrifice is to let go of something of a lower nature so you can take a hold of something of a higher nature. And the best way for us to live our lives, it's like it's been proven, it doesn't matter whether it's in finances, whether it's in health, whether it's in relationships, it doesn't matter what arena we're talking about, sacrificing the short term on the altar of the long term always ends better than sacrificing the long term on the altar of the short term. It always does. It's just like a principle of life. Okay, so now I know when I'm looking at my particular marketplace in whatever particular niche I'm looking at, then I know what I have to do if I want to create wealth is I have to figure out how to help somebody fill their past perceived voids, or how to win their present pursued victories, or how to fulfill their future pursued visions. How many of y'all check? How many of y'all check it? Tracking. Okay. So now when I'm looking at somebody, I know what kind of value, how to discover what you value. Because you're going to value one of those three things. Whatever you're working on in your life is probably going to fit into one of those three categories. Now, wealth is the result of value creation. The better your ability to create value for someone other than yourself, the wealthier you are. And sometimes that'll show up as money. Sometimes it'll show up as real estate. Sometimes it'll show up as like hard assets like gold and silver. But or it'll show up as digital assets like Bitcoin and Ethereum. But at the end of the day, whatever you pay for with money that you earned by creating value for someone other than yourself. So the very act of entrepreneurship, by its very nature, has to be self-sacrificing if you're going to win as an entrepreneur. How many of y'all got it? Wave at me. Say, I got it. Wave at me. Okay, good. Cool. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at what God set up in Genesis chapter 1, and I call it the four levels of value. So because here's what y'all, like, here's one of the things I think we don't understand sometimes. All value is not created equally, right? What does that mean? All value is not created equally. So I can say, wow, but I created this value. Yeah, but the problem is either you valued it or maybe one other person valued it. You wonder why. Like, if you're not doing well financially, I'm going to tell you why. Because the pool of people that you've decided to create value for is very small. Or the thing that you, the value that you've created for them, they value it at a very low level. Like, it's not like a big deal, right? I'm going to pay more for a car than I am for a pair of shoes. Why? That's a bigger value. Why? It can take me farther faster than a pair of shoes, right? So watch this. So, like, even if I go to eat at Ocean Prime or I go to eat at Eddie V's and it costs $500 for dinner for, like, seven people or whatever, I value that more than I value the money, number one. But I also value it because it gives me the time that I want to spend or invest into the people that I care about the most, and I don't have to, like, I don't have to make the food. My wife doesn't have to make the food. My daughter doesn't have to make the food. My son, my son-in-law, we can just sit down. We can go to dinner. We can pay somebody. They make all the stuff. Like, we don't have to go in the kitchen and do anything. We don't even have to open the refrigerator. It's amazing. They just keep bringing it to you. And then you don't have to clean off the table. I mean, if you don't want to, you don't even have to put your own pepper on your food. They'll put the pepper on for you. This is amazing. And then, when you get done, you don't have to clean the table up. You don't have to wash any dishes. You just leave. What? Sign me up right now. How many of y'all checking? Like, so we have to get to the place in our lives where we realize that all value is not created equally, right? So while I'm giving you things that are not created equally, let me give you something that is created equally. Because all value is not created equally, all no's are created equally, but all yeses are not. What do I mean all no's are created equally? If you do a presentation to a potential client who does not have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no, it feels the exact same as if you do a presentation to somebody who does have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no. A no is 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 a no. Does that make sense? Okay. But if you talk to somebody who does not have the ability to take advantage of your offer, and you make an offer to that person, and they say yes, that's very different than when you talk to a person who has the desire to take advantage of your offer, and they say yes. They have the ability. One has the ability, one doesn't have the ability. Those are two very different yeses. All no's are created equally. All yeses are not. Why would you invest time talking to people who have neither the desire nor the willingness to buy your offer? That's why I don't do high-pressure sales. I'm just not interested in it. I don't need your money. I don't want your money. And if I got to drag you in, I'm going to have to drag you around. Like we would all do better if we would just realize there are already thousands, potentially tens of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of people, maybe even millions of people in the world who would love to purchase the value that we create if they only knew we existed. And if that were really the case, then I would be better off to spend my time to make myself findable than I am trying to find somebody to sell something to. Is what I'm saying making sense? Okay, so all value is not created equally. In Genesis chapter 1 and 2, God gave us the four levels of value. The lowest level of value is implementation. Implementation, oh, by the way, let me say this. Wealth is, it's like the value we create for other people, but here's what you have to understand about wealth. Wealth is a spiritual result. What do I mean wealth is a spiritual result? Well, let me ask you a question. Is it more spiritual for you to think about you or for you to think about someone else? Which one? Someone else. It's more spiritual for you to think about solving the problems of someone other than you. Okay? So wealth is a spiritual result. By the way, wealth is also a spiritual result because creativity is spiritual, right? And so if you're going to create value for somebody, that's also spiritual. So watch this. So the lowest level of value is implementation. What do I mean? This is like if you're creating value for other people at the implementation level, you have limited. Who's limited? Everybody tap yourself on the chest, say I have. You've limited your ability to earn. Why? Because you're only going to make somewhere between minimum wage and about $80,000 a year. Well, that sounds kind of painful. Why? Because you're using muscles, which are a physical resource, over time, which is a limited resource. So you're literally using a physical resource over a limited resource to produce an unlimited spiritual result. No wonder you're stuck. This is why I tell people, now, if you just love like mowing grass, you want to start a lawn care company, that's fine. You just love pressure washing, you want to start a pressure washing business, that's fine. You can make money and create a limited level of wealth with a pressure washing business. You can. Or a landscape business or a janitorial service. But here's the problem. You're anchoring your income generation to time and physical labor. That is always going to pay you at the lowest possible level. Why? Because muscles are a physical resource. Time is a limited resource. Wealth is an unlimited spiritual result. Okay, what's the next level?
I'd like to tell you about the strangest secret in the world. Some years ago, the late Nobel Prize-winning Dr. Albert Schweitzer was being interviewed in London, and a reporter asked him, "Doctor, what's wrong with men today?" And the great doctor was silent a moment, and then he said, "Men simply don't think." It's about this that I want to talk with you. We live today in a golden age. This is an era that man has looked forward to, dreamed of, and worked toward for thousands of years. But since it's here, we pretty well take it for granted. We in America are particularly fortunate to live in the richest land that ever existed on the face of the earth, a land of abundant opportunity for everyone. But do you know what happens? Well, let's take 100 men who start even at the age of 25. Do you have any idea what will happen to those men by the time they're 65? These 100 men who all start even at the age of 25 believe they're going to be successful. If you ask any one of these men if he wanted to be a success, he'd tell you he did. And you'd notice that he was eager toward life, that there was a certain sparkle to his eye, an erectness to his carriage, and life seemed like a pretty interesting adventure to him. But by the time they're 65, one will be rich. Four will be financially independent. Five will still be working. 54 will be broke. Now think a moment. Out of the 100, only 5 make the grade. Now why do so many fail? What has happened to the sparkle that was there when they were 25? What's become of the dreams, the hopes, the plans? And why is there such a large disparity between what these men intended to do and what they actually accomplished? When we say about 5% achieve success, we have to define success. And here's the best definition I've ever been able to find. Success is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. If a man is working toward a predetermined goal and knows where he's going, that man is a success. If he's not doing that, he's a failure. Success is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. Rollo May, the distinguished psychiatrist, wrote a wonderful book called Man's Search for Himself. And in this book, he says, the opposite of courage in our society is not cowardice. It is conformity. And there you have the trouble today. It's conformity, people acting like everyone else without knowing why, without knowing where they're going. Now think of it. In America right now, there are over 18 million people 65 years of age and older. And most of them are broke. They're dependent on someone else for life's necessities. Now, we learn to read by the time we're 7. We learn to make a living by the time we're 25. Usually by that time, we're not only making a living, we're supporting a family. And yet, by the time we're 65, we haven't learned how to become financially independent in the richest land that has ever been known. Why? We conform. And the trouble is that we're acting like the wrong percentage group, the 95 who don't succeed. Now, why do these people conform? Well, they really don't know. These people believe that their lives are shaped by circumstances, by things that happen to them, by exterior forces. They're outer-directed people. A survey was made one time that covered a lot of men, working men, and these men were asked, why do you work? Why do you get up in the morning? 19 out of 20 had no idea. If you ask them, they'll say, well, everyone goes to work in the morning, and that's the reason they do it, because everyone else is doing it. Now, let's get back to our definition of success. Who succeeds? The only person who succeeds is the person who is progressively realizing a worthy ideal. He's the person who says, I'm going to become this, and then begins to work toward that goal. I'll tell you who the successful people are. A success is the school teacher who's teaching school because that's what he or she wants to do. The success is the woman who's a wife and mother because she wanted to become a wife and mother and is doing a good job of it. The success is the man who runs the corner gas station because that was his dream. That's what he wanted to do. The success is the successful salesman who wants to become a top-notch salesman and grow and build with his organization. A success is anyone who is doing deliberately a predetermined job because that's what he decided to do deliberately. But only 1 out of 20 does that. That's why today there isn't really any competition unless we make it for ourselves. Instead of competing, all we have to do is create. You know, for 20 years, I looked for the key which would determine what would happen to a human being. Was there a key I wanted to know which would make the future a promise that we could foretell to a large extent? Was there a key that would guarantee a person's becoming successful if he only knew about it and knew how to use it? Well, there is such a key, and I've found it. Have you ever wondered why so many men work so hard and honestly without ever achieving anything in particular? And others don't seem to work hard and yet seem to get everything? They seem to have the magic touch. You've heard them say that about someone. Everything he touches turns to gold. And have you ever noticed that a man who becomes successful tends to continue to become successful? And on the other hand, have you noticed how a man who's a failure tends to continue to fail? Well, it's because of goals. Some of us have goals, some don't. People with goals succeed because they know where they're going. It's that simple. Think of a ship leaving a harbor, and think of it with the complete voyage mapped out and planned. The captain and crew know exactly where it's going and how long it'll take. It has a definite goal. Now, 9,999 times out of 10,000, it will get to where it started out to get. Now, let's take another ship, just like the first, only let's not put a crew on it or a captain at the helm. Let's give it no aiming point, no goal, no destination. We just start the engines and let it go. I think you'll agree with me that if it gets out of the harbor at all, it will either sink or wind up on some deserted beach, a derelict. It can't go anyplace because it has no destination and no guidance, and it's the same with a human being. Take the salesman, for example. There's no other person in the world today with the future of a good salesman. Selling is the world's highest paid profession, if we're good at it and if we know where we're going. Every company needs top-notch salesmen, and they reward those men. The sky's the limit for them. But how many can you find? Someone once said the human race is fixed, not to prevent the strong from winning, but to prevent the weak from losing. The American economy today can be likened to a convoy in time of war. The entire economy is slowed down to protect its weakest link, just as the convoy had to go at the speed that would permit its slowest vessel to remain in formation. That's why it's so easy to make a living today. It takes no particular brains or talent to make a living and support a family today. So we have a plateau of so-called security, if that's what a person's looking for. But we do have to decide how high above this plateau we want to aim. Now let's get back to the strangest secret in the world, the story that I wanted to tell you today. Why do men with goals succeed in life and men without them fail? Well, let me tell you something which, if you really understand it, will alter your life immediately. If you understand completely what I'm going to tell you from this moment on, your life will never be the same again. You will suddenly find that good luck just seems to be attracted to you. The things you want just seem to fall in line, and from now on you won't have the problems, the worries, the gnawing lump of anxiety that perhaps you've experienced before. Doubt, fear, well, they'll be things of the past. Here's the key to success and the key to failure. We become what we think about. Now, let me say that again. We become what we think about. Throughout all history, the great wise men and teachers, philosophers and prophets have disagreed with one another on many different things. It's only on this one point that they are in complete and unanimous agreement. Listen to what Marcus Aurelius, the great Roman emperor, said. A man's life is what his thoughts make of it. Disraeli said this, "Everything comes if a man will only wait. I've brought myself by long meditation to the conviction that a human being with a settled purpose must accomplish it, and that nothing can resist a will that will stake even existence for its fulfillment." Ralph Waldo Emerson said this, "A man is what he thinks about all day long." William James said, "The greatest discovery of my generation is that human beings can alter their lives by altering their attitudes of mind." And he also said, "We need only in cold blood act as if the thing in question were real, and it will become infallibly real by growing into such a connection with our life that it will become real. It will become so knit with habit and emotion that our interests in it will be those which characterize belief." And he also said, "If you only care enough for a result, you will almost certainly attain it. If you wish to be rich, you will be rich. If you wish to be learned, you will be learned. If you wish to be good, you will be good. Only you must then really wish these things and wish them exclusively and not wish at the same time 100 other incompatible things just as strongly." In the Bible, you read in Mark 9:23, "If thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believeth." My old friend Dr. Norman Vincent Peale put it this way, "This is one of the greatest laws in the universe. Fervently do I wish I had discovered it as a very young man. It dawned upon me much later in life, and I found it to be one of the greatest, if not my greatest discovery outside of my relationship to God. The great law, briefly and simply stated, is that if you think in negative terms, you will get negative results. If you think in positive terms, you will achieve positive results. That is the simple fact," he went on to say, "which is at the basis of an astonishing law of prosperity and success. In three words, believe and succeed." William Shakespeare put it this way, "Our doubts are traitors and make us lose the good we oft might win by fearing to attempt." George Bernard Shaw said, "People are always blaming their circumstances for what they are. I don't believe in circumstances. The people who get on in this world are the people who get up and look for the circumstances they want, and if they can't find them, make them." Well, it's pretty apparent, isn't it? And every person who discovered this for a while believed that he was the first one to work it out. We become what we think about. Now, it stands to reason that a person who's thinking about a concrete and worthwhile goal is going to reach it, because that's what he's thinking about, and we become what we think about. Conversely, the man who has no goal, who doesn't know where he's going, and whose thoughts must therefore be thoughts of confusion and anxiety and fear and worry, becomes what he thinks about. His life becomes one of frustration and fear and anxiety and worry. And if he thinks about nothing, he becomes nothing. Now, how does it work? Why do we become what we think about? Well, I'll tell you how it works as far as we know. Now, to do this, I want to tell you about a situation that parallels the human mind. Suppose a farmer has some land, and it's good, fertile land. Now, the land gives the farmer a choice. He may plant in that land whatever he chooses. The land doesn't care. It's up to the farmer to make the decision. Now, remember, we're comparing the human mind with the land because the mind, like the land, doesn't care what you plant in it. It will return what you plant, but it doesn't care what you plant. Now, let's say that the farmer has two seeds in his hand. One is a seed of corn. The other is nightshade, a deadly poison. He digs two little holes in the earth, and he plants both seeds, one corn, the other nightshade. He covers up the holes, waters, and takes care of the land, and what will happen? Invariably, the land will return what's planted. As it's written in the Bible, "As ye sow, so shall ye reap." Now remember, the land doesn't care. It'll return poison in just as wonderful abundance as it will corn. So up come the two plants. One corn, one poison. Now the human mind is far more fertile, far more incredible and mysterious than the land, but it works the same way. It doesn't care what we plant. Success, failure. A concrete, worthwhile goal, or confusion. Misunderstanding, fear, anxiety, and so on. But what we plant, it must return to us. You see, the human mind is the last great unexplored continent on Earth. It contains riches beyond our wildest dreams. It will return anything we want to plant. Now, you might say, well, if that's true, why don't people use their minds more? Well, I think they figured out an answer to that one, too. Our mind comes as standard equipment at birth. It's free, and things that are given to us for nothing, we place little value on. Things that we pay money for, we value. The paradox is that exactly the reverse is true. Everything that's really worthwhile in life came to us free. Our minds, our souls, our bodies, our hopes, our dreams, our ambitions, our intelligence, our love of family and children and friends and country, all these priceless possessions are free. But the things that cost us money are actually very cheap and can be replaced at any time. A good man can be completely wiped out and make another fortune. He can do that several times. Even if our home burns down, we can rebuild it. But the things we got for nothing, we can never replace. The human mind isn't used because we take it for granted. Familiarity breeds contempt. It can do any kind of job we assign to it, but generally speaking, we use it for little jobs instead of big, important ones. Universities have proved that most of us are operating on about 10% or less of our abilities. So decide now, what is it you want? Plant your goal in your mind. It's the most important decision you ever make in your entire life. What is it you want? Do you want to be an outstanding salesman? A better worker at your particular job? Do you want to go places in your company, in your community? Do you want to get rich? All you've got to do is plant that seed in your mind, care for it, work steadily toward your goal, and it will become a reality. It not only will, there's no way that it cannot. You see, that's a law, like the laws of Sir Isaac Newton, the laws of gravity. If you get on top of a building and jump off, you'll always go down. You'll never go up, and it's the same with all the other laws of nature. They always work. They're inflexible. Think about your goal in a relaxed, positive way. Picture yourself in your mind's eye as having already achieved this goal. See yourself doing the things you will be doing when you've reached your goal. Ours has been called the phenobarbital age, the age of ulcers and nervous breakdowns and tranquilizers, at a time when medical research has raised us to a new plateau of good health and longevity. Far too many of us worry ourselves into an early grave, trying to cope with things in our own little personal ways, without learning a few great laws that will take care of everything for us. These things we bring on ourselves through our habitual way of thinking. Every one of us is the sum total of his own thoughts. He is where he is because that's exactly where he really wants to be, whether he'll admit that or not. Each of us must live off the fruit of his thoughts in the future, because what you think today and tomorrow, next month and next year, will mold your life and determine your future. You're guided by your mind. I remember one time I was driving through eastern Arizona, and I saw one of those giant earth-moving machines roaring along the road at about 35 miles an hour with what looked like 30 tons of dirt in it, a tremendous, incredible machine, and there was a little man perched way up on top with the wheel in his hands guiding it. And as I drove along, I was struck by the similarity of that machine to the human mind. Just suppose you're sitting at the controls of such a vast source of energy. Are you going to sit back and fold your arms and let it run itself into a ditch? Or are you going to keep both hands firmly on the wheel and control and direct this power to a specific, worthwhile purpose? It's up to you. You're in the driver's seat. You see, the very law that gives us success is a two-edged sword. We must control our thinking. The same rule that can lead a man to a life of success, wealth, happiness, and all the things he ever dreamed of for himself and his family. That very same law can lead him into the gutter. It's all in how he uses it, for good or for bad. This is the strangest secret in the world. Now, why do I say it's strange, and why do I call it a secret? Actually, it isn't a secret at all. It was first promulgated by some of the earliest wise men, and it appears again and again throughout the Bible, but very few people have learned it, understand it. That's why it's strange, and why, for some equally strange reason, it virtually remains a secret. I believe that you could go out and walk down the main street of your town and ask one man after another what the secret of success is, and you probably wouldn't run into one man in a month who could tell you. Now, this information is enormously valuable to us if we really understand it and apply it. It's valuable to us not only for our own lives, but the lives of those around us, our families, employees, associates, and friends. Life should be an exciting adventure. It should never be a bore. A man should live fully, be alive. He should be glad to get out of bed in the morning. He should be doing a job he likes to do because he does it well. One time I heard Grove Patterson, the great late editor-in-chief of the Toledo Daily Blade, make a speech, and as he concluded his speech, he said something I've never forgotten. He said, "My years in the newspaper business have convinced me of several things. Among them, that people are basically good, and that we came from someplace and we're going someplace. So we should make our time here an exciting adventure. The architect of the universe didn't build a stairway leading nowhere." And the greatest teacher of all, the carpenter from the plains of Galilee, gave us the secret time and time again. "As ye believe, so shall it be done unto you." I've explained the strangest secret in the world and how it works. Now, on this side, I want to explain how you can prove to yourself the enormous returns possible in your own life by putting this secret to a practical test. I want you to make a test that will last 30 days. It isn't going to be easy, but if you'll give it a good try, it will completely change your life for the better. Now, back in the 17th century, Sir Isaac Newton, the English mathematician and natural philosopher, gave us some natural laws of physics which apply as much to human beings as they do to the movement of bodies in the universe. And one of these laws is that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Simply stated, as it applies to you and me, it means we can achieve nothing without paying the price. The results of your 30-day experiment will be in direct proportion to the effort you put forth. To be a doctor, you must pay the price of long years of difficult study. To be successful in selling, and remember that each of us succeeds to the extent of his ability to sell, selling our families on our ideas, selling education in schools, selling our children on the advantages of living the good and honest life, selling our associates and employees on the importance of being exceptional people, to, of course, the profession of selling itself. But to be successful in selling our way to the good life, we must be willing to pay the price. Now, what is that price? Well, it's many things. First, it's understanding emotionally, as well as intellectually, that we literally become what we think about, that we must control our thoughts if we're to control our lives. It's understanding fully that, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. Second, it's cutting away all fetters from the mind and permitting it to soar as it was divinely designed to do. It's the realization that your limitations are self-imposed and that the opportunities for you today are enormous beyond belief. It's rising above narrow-minded pettiness and prejudice. And third, it's using all your courage to force yourself to think positively on your own problem, to set a definite and clearly defined goal for yourself, to let your marvelous mind think about your goal from all possible angles, to let your imagination speculate freely upon many different possible solutions, to refuse to believe that there are any circumstances sufficiently strong to defeat you in the accomplishment of your purpose, to act promptly and decisively when your course is clear, and to keep constantly aware of the fact that you are, at this moment, standing in the middle of your own acres of diamonds, as Russell Conwell used to point out. And fourth, save at least 10% of every dollar you earn. It's also remembering that no matter what your present job, it has enormous possibilities if you're willing to pay the price. Now let's just go over the important points in the price each of us must pay to achieve the wonderful life that can be ours. It is, of course, worth any price. 1. You will become what you think about. 2. Remember the word imagination and let your mind begin to soar. 3. Courage. Concentrate on your goal every day. 4. Save 10% of what you earn. And 5. Action. Ideas are worthless unless we act on them. Now, I'll try to outline the 30-day test I want you to make. Keep in mind that you have nothing to lose by making this test and everything you could possibly want to gain. There are two things that may be said of everyone. Each of us wants something, and each of us is afraid of something. I want you to write on a card what it is you want more than anything else. It may be more money. Perhaps you'd like to double your income or make a specific amount of money. It may be a beautiful home. It may be success at your job. It may be a particular position in life. It could be a more harmonious family. Each of us wants something. Now write down on your card specifically what it is you want. Make sure it's a single goal and clearly defined. You needn't show it to anyone, but carry it with you so that you can look at it several times a day. Think about it in a cheerful, relaxed, positive way each morning when you get up. And immediately you have something to work for, something to get out of bed for, something to live for. Look at it every chance you get during the day and just before going to bed at night. And as you look at it, remember that you must become what you think about, and since you're thinking about your goal, you realize that soon it will be yours. In fact, it's yours really the moment you write it down and begin to think about it. Look at the abundance all around you as you go about your daily business. You have as much right to this abundance as any other living creature. It's yours for the asking. Now we come to the difficult part. Difficult because it means the formation of what is probably a brand new habit, and new habits are not easily formed. Once formed, however, it will follow you for the rest of your life. Stop thinking about what it is you fear. Each time a fearful or negative thought comes into your consciousness, replace it with a mental picture of your positive and worthwhile goal. And there will come times when you'll feel like giving up. It's easier for a human being to think negatively than positively. That's why only 5% are successful. You must begin now to place yourself in that group. For 30 days, you must take control of your mind. It will think about only what you permit it to think about. Each day for this 30-day test, do more than you have to do. In addition to maintaining a cheerful, positive outlook, give of yourself more than you've ever done before. Do this knowing that your returns in life must be in direct proportion to what you give. The moment you decide on a goal to work toward, you're immediately a successful person. You are then in that rare and successful category of people who know where they're going. Out of every 100 people, you belong to the top 5. Don't concern yourself too much with how you're going to achieve your goal. Leave that completely to a power greater than yourself. All you have to do is know where you're going. The answers will come to you of their own accord and at the right time. Remember these words from the Sermon on the Mount, and remember them well. Keep them constantly before you this month of your test. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For every one that asketh, receiveth, and he that seeketh, findeth, and to him that knocketh, it shall be opened. It's as marvelous and as simple as that. In fact, it's so simple that in our seemingly complicated world, it's difficult for an adult to understand it. All he needs is a purpose and faith. For 30 days, do your very best. If you're a salesman, go at it as you've never done before. Not in a hectic fashion, but with the calm, cheerful assurance that time well spent will give you the abundance in return you deserve and want. If you're a homemaker, devote your 30-day test to completely giving of yourself without thinking about receiving anything in return, and you'll be amazed at the difference it makes in your life. No matter what your job, do it as you've never done it before for 30 days. And if you've kept your goal before you every day, you will wonder and marvel at this new life you've found. Dorothea Brand, the outstanding editor and writer, discovered it for herself and tells about it in her fine book, Wake Up and Live. Her entire philosophy is reduced to the words, act as though it were impossible to fail. She made her own test with sincerity and faith, and her entire life was changed to one of overwhelming success. Now, you make your test for 30 full days. Don't start your test until you've made up your mind to stick with it. You see, by being persistent, you're demonstrating faith. Persistence is simply another word for faith. If you didn't have faith, you'd never persist. If you should fail during your first 30 days, by that I mean suddenly find yourself overwhelmed by negative thoughts, you've got to start over again from that point and go 30 more days. Gradually, your new habit will form until you find yourself one of that wonderful minority to whom virtually nothing is impossible. And don't forget the card. It's vitally important as you begin this new way of living. On one side of the card, write your goal, whatever it may be. On the other side, write the words we've quoted from the Sermon on the Mount. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. Nothing great was ever accomplished without inspiration. See that during these crucial first 30 days, your own inspiration is kept at a peak. And above all, don't worry. Worry brings fear, and fear is crippling. The only thing that can cause you to worry during your test is trying to do it all yourself. Know that all you have to do is hold your goal before you. Everything else will take care of itself. Remember also to keep calm and cheerful. Don't let petty things annoy you and get you off course. Now, since making this test is difficult, some will say, why should I bother? Well, look at the alternative. No one wants to be a failure. No one really wants to be a mediocre individual. No one wants a life constantly filled with worry and fear and frustration. Therefore, remember that you must reap that which you sow. If you sow negative thoughts, your life will be filled with negative things. If you sow positive thoughts, your life will be cheerful, successful, and positive. Now, gradually, you will have a tendency to forget what you've heard on this recording. Play it often. Keep reminding yourself of what you must do to form this new habit. Gather your whole family around at regular intervals and listen to what's been said here. You know, most men will tell you that they want to make money without understanding the law. The only people who make money work in a mint. The rest of us must earn money. This is what causes those who keep looking for something for nothing or a free ride to fail in life. The only way to earn money is by providing people with services or products which are needed and useful. We exchange our time and our product or service for the other man's money. Therefore, the law is that our financial return will be in direct proportion to our service. Now, success is not the result of making money. Making money is the result of success, and success is in direct proportion to our service. Most people have this law backwards. They believe that you're successful if you earn a lot of money. The truth is that you can only earn money after you're successful. It's like the story of the man who sat in front of the stove and said to it, "Give me heat, and then I'll add the wood." How many men and women do you know, or do you suppose there are today, who take the same attitude toward life? There are millions. We've got to put the fuel in before we can expect heat. Likewise, we've got to be of service first before we can expect money. Don't concern yourself with the money. Be of service. Build, work, dream, create. Do this and you'll find there's no limit to the prosperity and abundance that will come to you. Prosperity, you know, is founded upon a law of mutual exchange. Any person who contributes to prosperity must prosper in turn himself. Sometimes the return will not come from those you serve, but it must come to you from someplace, because that's the law. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. As you go daily through your 30-day test period, remember that your success will always be measured by the quality and quantity of service you render, and money is a yardstick for measuring this service. No man can get rich himself unless he enriches others. Now, there are no exceptions to a law. You can drive down any street in America and from your car estimate the service that's being rendered by the people living on that street. Had you ever thought of this yardstick before? It's interesting. Some, like ministers and priests and other devoted people, measure their returns in the realm of the spiritual. But again, their returns are equal to their service. Once this law is fully understood, any thinking person can tell his own fortune. If he wants more, he must be of more service to those from whom he receives his return. If he wants less, he has only to reduce his service. This is the price you must pay for what you want. If you believe you can enrich yourself by deluding others, you can end only by deluding yourself. It may take some time, but just as surely as you breathe, you'll get back what you put out. Don't ever make the mistake of thinking you can avert this. It's impossible. The prisons and the streets where the lonely walk are filled with people who tried to make new laws just for themselves. We may avoid the laws of man for a while, but there are greater laws that cannot be broken. An outstanding medical doctor recently pointed out 6 steps that will help you realize success. 1. Set yourself a definite goal. 2. Quit running yourself down. 3. Stop thinking of all the reasons why you cannot be successful and instead think of all the reasons why you can. 4. Trace your attitudes back through your childhood and try to discover where you first got the idea you couldn't be successful, if that's the way you've been thinking. 5. Change the image you have of yourself by writing out a description of the person you would like to be. And 6. Act the part of the successful person you have decided to become. The doctor who wrote those words is a noted West Coast psychiatrist, Dr. David Harold Fink. Do what the experts since the dawn of recorded history have told you you must do. Pay the price by becoming the person you want to become. It's not nearly as difficult as living unsuccessfully. Make your 30-day test, then repeat it again, and each time it will become more a part of you until you'll wonder how you could ever have lived any other way. Live this new way and the floodgates of abundance will open and pour over you more riches than you may have dreamed existed. Money? Yes, lots of it. But what's more important, you'll have peace. You'll be in that wonderful minority who lead calm, cheerful, successful lives. Start today. You have nothing to lose, but you have a whole life to win. This is Earl Nightingale, and thank you.
Hey everyone, Sam Ovens here, and today I have Danielle Leslie on with us. And Danielle's got an awesome story. And she started a few years ago working at Udemy, which is like an online course company. And she was helping online course sellers to get more customers and generate more money using the Udemy platform. And she got started there, and then later on she decided to start her own business helping people start their first online course. So really helping people who have some experience or a really good story or things that they've learned from that they can teach other people to help them in their own lives, and helping them really take that knowledge and turn it into an online course that they can sell and generate money doing it. And Danielle's been pretty successful with this. She, within her first 2 years of doing this, she was making $130,000 per month. And then Danielle joined Consulting Accelerator and then Quantum Mastermind. And then very quickly, she was able to get to about $250,000 per month. And then in January this year, you had a month where you made, what, $850,000?
Yeah, $830,000.
So those are some pretty awesome numbers in a pretty short amount of time. And on today's interview, we're going to discuss how that happened and really dig into some of the details so that you can learn from Danielle's experience. So thanks for jumping on with me today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So let's go back to Udemy days, and you're sitting there and you're helping these online course sellers. Why did you decide to leave and really start your own thing?
Yeah, so it's interesting because by the time I got to Udemy, I had already actually tried creating, well, I'd already created and launched my own course in 2012 just on my own. So I had my first kind of launch just on my own, doing a live version, basically what I teach today. And when I reached a ceiling with that, that's when I joined Udemy to kind of like level up. So at Udemy, I got to kind of, I guess, learn more. And I learned that actually you can create a course on any topic. And I learned that you don't need an audience to be successful with it. And so in all of that experience, I learned that, you know what, I know that like this is my purpose. I love working with people of different backgrounds. And so after Udemy, because by that time that was my third online course I created while I was at Udemy, it just got the attention of another startup. And so I left after about 3 years and worked for another startup. And so the reason I ended up starting my own business was by accident. I got laid off from that other startup in fall of 2015. So when that happened, I thought I would just go out and get another marketing director job at another startup. But I had friends reaching out to me and saying, hey, can I hire you to consult me? Like our company is launching their first course. Can you come on and show me how to market to small business owners? Can you help me launch my course and help me with this ebook? So in the first 30 days, I made over $10,000 just from people in my network who I had been kind of advising and giving advice to over the years. And that's kind of where it grew from there.
Got it. So the piece of advice that they were seeking from you, and it seems like what your expertise is getting that first course built and created and out the door.
Yeah, back then, that's what I was really good at. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Got it.
And it was really leveraging like my background in startups, right? It's like I co-founded a startup in 2010, and one of the big things I learned was that the best way to get things out of the door, make an impact in this world, is to ask yourself, how can I solve my customers' problems with no tech? Like, no tech necessary, what is the fastest way from A to B? How do I get this out into the world? And so, yeah, so that's how I started with building my courses. Like, my first course launch was, like, no tech. And then, yeah, that was kind of, like, my method that I started teaching people.
And by no tech, do you mean, like, no writing code?
Yeah.
Because we still need a computer, right?
I know. I consider like a computer, not no tech. But yes, all you need is like an internet connection. So how can I teach my course live, right? That was the first version of my course, was teaching it live over, I think I used like Google Hangout. So yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, no sales page, none of those softwares, platforms, things like that.
Got it. That makes sense. And when you first started teaching people how to do this, like they came to you, how did they know that you knew how to help them?
Yeah, so it was based on the little information that I was putting out on my Facebook page. So ever since, you know, probably 2010, when we co-founded that startup, it's like I was tweeting back when Twitter was a thing for me. You know, so it was just me sharing these breadcrumbs along my whole career. Just saying, oh, now I'm working at Udemy. So excited to be helping people do this. And then after that, it was, oh, now I'm helping this client. It was really all those breadcrumbs I left on my personal Facebook page, you know, just sharing my knowledge in real time. And because of that, and because of in-person interactions, people would come to me and say, hey, I've got this issue. What do you think? Those are the reasons people knew I could help them. And it was a lot of imperfect stuff. So one of the, you know, the job I got at Udemy was because they saw these like wacky YouTube videos I used to do like back in the day that looked terrible, that my sister would shoot for me in the backyard when I had to move in with my mom when I was broke. But it's like leaving those little, you know, breadcrumbs online showed people, oh, she actually knows what she's talking about. So yeah, so that was really it.
Got it. And how did you sell this to them? Like, because at that time you probably didn't have a course set up for this and pricing and a whole business built around it. Like, how did you approach that?
Yeah, so I started with consulting. So yeah, first it was just selling over the phone, sending people to an invoice over FreshBooks.
Okay, we're back for another installment of DIY Shacks, Build Your Own Housing, here on a Friday. And we have a very special guest. As a matter of fact, today, we've been doing this podcast for 10 years. So today we're launching, we're test driving a new segment which we'll feature on Friday, which I call The Faith Factory. But I'll go more into details of what that is. So it gives you some motivation. So this past weekend, well, last weekend, because we're now going into a new weekend, it's Friday already, it popped up in my, news feed or whatever on YouTube, some motivational, what I would consider motivational, which I think a lot of people need to hear. So we have in our studio live, Church Sister, that's her Facebook name, YouTube name, Church Sister. And Church Sister, good morning.
Good morning, L.A. Davis.
Good. Now, what time is it there? Because you're in Jamaica.
Yes, I am.
Oh, wait, it's 11:12, no, it's 11:42 here. So there it is, what time?
It is 11:42 here in Jamaica.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, you know, Jamaica's a short ride from Florida. I'm in the middle of the state of Florida right now. In any event, so you have a YouTube channel, and tell us about your YouTube channel. And like I said, I saw a video that you did. I don't know when you did it, but I saw it for the first time Sunday. It was like the first thing in my news feed. And I said, man, I got motivated by that. So I said, let me share this. That's why I reached out to you. So tell us a little bit about yourself and then your testimony.
Okay. So my name is Camelia. I go by Diary of a Church Sister on YouTube, Facebook, and on Instagram. Now, Diary of a Church Sister started on YouTube simply because I believe that the Holy Spirit said to me, do this. Share your testimony. When I started doing like presentation, like an inspirational talks in different congregations and even for FUI Jamaica, that's an organization that we have here in Jamaica for persons who've been through trauma. So I started doing that. But when I started sharing in the different congregations, one lady, she was like 80-something. She came up to me and she said to me, thank you for sharing your story. I've never shared my story before, and some of what happened to you happened to me. So thank you very much for being brave enough to share, because it has helped me. And then another lady in another congregation said to me, come here, can you hold my hand? I want to share my story for the first time. I want to tell the congregation. And because you shared your story, I now have the courage to share, but I want you to support me. And so I went up there with her, and she shared her story, among other experiences that I've had with church sisters. And so out of that, I decided I didn't just want to share in a local church. I wanted to help persons across the world, because I believe that church sisters have gone through a lot, but we don't really share it. So we put on this facade. And so the Holy Spirit impressed upon me to just share my story, share my testimony. Sometimes I can be a bit hesitant, because sometimes I'm afraid of what persons are going to say. So sometimes I don't share or take long to upload a video. But it has been a blessing to others, and I'm just very grateful. Currently, I'm a student at Northern Caribbean University. I'm pursuing a bachelor's degree in counseling, and I'm going to be doing a minor in psychology, but I plan also to do my master's after I finish studying for my bachelor's.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I'm a church sister. I love to have fun, and I believe that we should all live an authentic life, and I believe in counseling, because it has helped me personally to realize who I am, to start my healing journey. As I continue on my healing journey, it has helped me, and it has also helped me to show up for others.
Okay. All right. Well, now, the testimony that I saw that motivated me to contact you, like, well, let me think, because I saw a lot that last Sunday, but I think it was on Naiva. Your was it your electric bill or rent?
Yes. So
yeah, share that testimony.
Okay. So L.A. Lewis, I must say thank you so much for inviting me here. That testimony came out of, it was during the pandemic. I had started a business before the pandemic, and it was going well, but slowly but surely things started to dwindle. And then during the pandemic, things got really rough, and I really had to just pack up and decided. It got to the point where I had to make a decision whether or not I was going to keep the shop open, or I was going to don't live anywhere and keep the shop open, or I have somewhere to live and I can do here, there. So I closed my business down and I was in from home. However, when everything got really, really serious, I stopped making money, like no money at all. And no, I didn't have any money to pay rent, but God would always provide food for me. People would just call and say, would you like something? They'd send money for me for food and something. But it got to the point one day I was sitting down, I was praying and asking God to come through for me. And the voice came, move, it's time for you to move back home. And I wondered, like, where is home? Because the home that I grew up in as a child, that was taken over by other in-laws and something when my mother, who is my aunt's mommy, when she died. Also, going back to live with my father wasn't something that I wanted to do. I was really afraid of doing it based on the different things that happened to me when I was younger, to go back in that community where I was molested and raped. That wasn't something that I really wanted to do. So I asked God, where his home? I really and truly have no home more than where I'm renting now. And he said, it's time for you to go home. And I said, all right. So by faith, I started packing up. I didn't know where I was going to go. I didn't know where I was going to get the money from. I remember one day I went on Facebook Live, and I was up there talking, and I was saying that I'm so frustrated. The pandemic is affecting me now. It has affected me in a very bad way, and I really don't know what to do. And I started crying because now I had to deal with all the unresolved issues that I had. Extroverts, those who are extroverted, so the hugging, and I we couldn't touch anybody. So I was alone. So I went on Facebook to talk about those things. A friend reached out to me, and she said to me, and she called me and she said, I saw your thing on Facebook. I saw the live on Facebook, and I wanted to reach out to you to find out how things going. And I said to her, you know, God told me to move. I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do, but I know I need to move because, one, the resource has been cut off as it relates to paying this rent. So I now need somewhere to live. And I was in dialogue with another friend because he was saying to me, okay, my uncle has somewhere, but you'd have to pay the rent. So I was telling her about that now, that somebody told me about somewhere in another parish, but I'd have to pack up my things somewhere. And so we had that dialogue. And she said, you know what? I'm going to let you stay. My mother has somewhere, and I'm going to let you live with my mother. I'm going to let you live downstairs, but I'll pay the rent for you. No.
Mm.
She said she was going to let me live there. And I said, okay. And like on the day when I was moving, before the truck came, Ellie Lewis, I was there, and she called me and she said, you know, my mother, she's not in agreement with the whole you staying down there. She kind of flipped the script. So guess what? I am going to pay the rent for you. I'm going to pay your rent for 6 months.
Mm.
And I'm like, okay.
If that's not a miracle or whatever you want to call it, provision.
Listen, that was pure miracle. And she said, I'm going to pay it for 6 months. You don't need to worry yourself. I'm going to pay for the truck. I'm going to pay for everything until you get back on your feet. But before that instance, before that miracle took place, let's go back a couple months before, as I told you before, the business was kind of going down because God was leading me in a direction that I did not want to go in. So everybody was saying to me, Camille, I believe that because, as I said, I used to go around and speak, and even persons would come into the salon just to get some advice from me. And so persons kept saying to me, Camille, I think you should go and study counseling instead of being a hairdresser. You need to do more. But I was very reluctant. I didn't want to do any of that. So I believe that it was just mere provision that God said, listen, you're not going to do this anymore because I'm leading you in another direction. So I didn't have any money. And so my friend, another friend, called me one day and we were talking and she said, girl, what's happening to you? And I said to her, no, man, I'm good. We were talking about some other young lady because you were on this prayer line. So we were talking about the goodness of God in some other young lady's life. And I said, boy, I see God working in so many persons' life, and sometimes I just wish that he would work. And she said, what's happening to you? And I told her what was happening. And let me tell you, she paid my rent for 6 months too. And I'm like, in that moment,
man,
I'm like,
that's amazing.
So countless times God has done it in so many different ways. But let's just go back to when I moved from, I was living in St. Anne. Let's go back to when I moved from St. Anne. And so when my friend said that she was going to pay my rent for 6 months, I said, okay. And I moved. And I was in a two-bedroom, living and dining, bathroom, and it was comfortable, right?
Yeah.
But let me tell you about when God tells you to do something and you don't do it.
Yeah, you're right about that.
I was there and everything was going okay. Then something started happening and started getting sick because of the mold. But all this time, God was just directing me in the right path. remember I said that God had told me to move my things to my father's house, and I did not, and to go back home, and I couldn't understand where home was. Anyhow, for that time, that 6 months, I was able to get my head in the right place, and then I made up my mind to move my things to my father's house. No, this is God providing all the way. Then I got somewhere else to live. A lady just, I was talking to my church this morning, she said to me, you know, I have an apartment. I'm going to let you stay there for a while till I get back up. And I moved back to St. Anne. But in moving back to St. Anne, I felt this need to go to Manchester to live. And I'm like, why do I want to go back to Manchester to live? And I said, you know, I'm not going to be in St. Anne for much longer, I believe. I believe I'm going to live in Manchester. So I started looking work in Manchester, and I started doing the most. My friend that helped me with mine for 6 months, she was. We were also trying to find a place for me to salon, but that was not happening. And one day she said to me while we were on the road, she said, Camilla, we stopped at a bookstore across from my now university, and she said to me, I don't think that God wants you to open a salon. I see your picture on this bookstore glass advertising your book. I believe that you should go back to school. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. You're not doing that part. Anyhow, when I moved my things to my father's house and I went back to St. Anne, because this is now me, I was in Manchester, then I moved back. Move my things to my father's house. I wasn't living there because I said I never felt safe in the community. So I wasn't living there, actually. And when another church sister offered me somewhere to stay, to live, an entire house to live in, and I said, it's not just a small house, a big house, two stories. And I'm like, Lord, what have I done to deserve these miracles after another? And in one day, I said to my girlfriend, you know, I think we've been talking about this for years. I think you should open a restaurant, and she finally did it. And I sent her congratulations, and she said to me, I want you to come and help me for the weekend, for the opening. And so she's in Manchester. And I said, all right, I'll come and help you. And I moved. Okay. I came down to Manchester to help her for the weekend, and L.A. Davis, I've not moved since. I've been here attending school. And even while attending school, let me tell you, I started working, and God said, this is not what I want you to do. And I started feeling uncomfortable. I got somewhere else to live. I got somewhere to live, and I lived there for a couple months. And God said, it's time to go back to school. Plain as day, when I went to him and I said, why am I here? What am I doing here? I'm trying to open a salon. At first, I couldn't get any shop for myself. I rented a station, and I'm just struggling financially. Why am I here? What am I doing here? I can't deal with this. And when I got to the point when I said, Lord, whatever you want me to do, I'm going to do. I heard that still small voice. Time to go.
Let me ask you something. Now, Jamaica, I haven't been there, been invited there, but I haven't taken an invitation yet. What's the cost of housing there? Because I imagine in like a place like Kingston, it'll probably be more expensive, and then you got a certain amount of people that live in the rural areas of Jamaica where the cost of housing might be less expensive, but I don't know. So what's you know, cost of living like there?
Well, in Kingston, for persons that's renting, I believe you can get like maybe a one-bedroom or so for $40,000-something. And that's a small place, really and truly. The rent is really high, expensive in some areas. Well, I believe right now, even in some rural areas, rent is expensive, right? Because normally, before, you could get somewhere for like 20-something, maybe 25 or 15, but it's hard to find those. But especially in Kingston, you're paying rent for like $30,000, $45,000, $60,000. I see places renting for $150,000. I'm like, what? So rent is really high, and when it comes on to like buying property here in Jamaica, you have property for like $13 million, and that would be considered cheap now. right?
Okay.
But you have properties that go in for like $50 million. It just all depends on who you are.
Tristan, let me explain something real quick. I understand what the figures you're talking about for the people that are listening, particularly Americans, whatever. She's talking about Jamaican dollars. Okay. All right, Jamaican dollars. So you can go online, people that are listening to us, go online, and they're free. Get the download a currency converter app to your phone or whatever device you use. That way, if you got United States dollars, you can figure, when you're listening to it, like 30 million, just plug it in, 30 million Jamaican dollars, and then what does that translate to United States dollars or euros or what have you? So,
I believe.
But let me tell you this, though. Let me tell you this, church sister and audience. If you want to see where the ball is going, now this is particularly United States citizens. The figures that she's talking about in Jamaica right now, that will translate into dollars with inflation, I would say, I don't know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, I don't know, but it's coming to the United States.
Hmm.
Just so whatever figures you hear her say, just translate that to dollars in the USA. It is coming, and it's coming sooner than you think. Turn sister back to you.
Yes. If you translate, if you convert it into U.S., it's like, because I've seen houses being advertised for like 1,500 U.S., 2,500 U.S. per month. That's like based like St. Anne or Mobile tourist area, right?
Right.
And I'm like, wow, really? Now, like 1,500 U.S. or so is about 200 and something thousand Jamaican dollars. That's a whole heap of money. Now, the average Jamaican may be working like $150,000 per month. That's for some persons. Minimum wage here is $13,000 per week.
Okay, hold on, Trish. You said the minimum wage there on average is how much per week?
$13,000 per week.
Right, $13,000 per week. All right, now that translates to people that are living to the United States, $232.62. That it fluctuates. Now I'm saying, and I'm glad you're throwing out these figures, church sister, is the $13,000 a week. Now that's Jamaican dollars. What I'm saying, with inflation, those of you who live in Miami, Orlando, Los Angeles, Seattle, Washington, Washington, D.C., New York City, Chicago, Dallas, Houston, Texas, San Antonio, San Diego. Coming soon, you will need $13,000 a week or bare minimum $13,000 a month to live in a decent place in those cities.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I like talking to people like you, Trish, just because you can, like I say, if you want to look into the future, get outside the borders of the United States. Anyway, church sister, back to you.
So, L.A. Lewis, per month, that's like $52,000 for the month, and that's before taxes are taken out, right?
Right, right.
Now, if your house is, if the average house rent now is $30,000, $35,000, $40,000, you know that person will not have any money. You have nothing at all after that. But we're not talking about bus transportation costs. We're not even talking about electrical bill, gas bill, light, water bill. We're not talking about all those things as yet. We're just talking about rent, right?
Right.
So then you can just imagine for somebody like me who at the time my business just went down. It went down. No money was coming in. It was just divinely orchestrated that he allowed my friends to say to me, Camila, I'm willing to help you. And I know that oftentimes persons are struggling and you can't see a way out and you're wondering, what am I going to do? How am I going to pay the rent this month? God has a way of just showing up in so many different ways. A month may pass, 2 months may pass, but I think it is due to say, Lord, what am I doing that I should not be doing? Is there a direction that you're leading me in that I refuse to go in? Do you want me to step out in faith? Because sometimes we are stuck in one place simply because we are not following the leading of God, right? So we are not following his leading and we're stuck and God is saying, move left. But we are moving, we want to stay in the same position or we want to go right because we're afraid of what is down the road. But God already knows, and if he says go left because he will provide for you. I tell people that God is, well, the Bible says that God is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we could ever ask or even imagine. And what he has done for me, he's able to do it for anybody. He just asks us to fully to surrender our lives to him and just watch him work, walk in obedience and watch him work, watch one miracle come after the other, because it doesn't matter how high inflation gets, my God, he can do any and everything. There is nothing that is impossible for him. So if you are in that space where the resources have dried up, the pandemic has caused a whole heap of issues with you financially, just sit down and ask God, go into his word, go into the Bible. And I talk about my faith because it is my faith that has taken me through many rough seasons. Right now, I'm at university and one day I was washing. And as washing, I remember I'm a full-time student. I can't pay my rent. I'm there. I'm back in that position. And I'm saying, God, why am I here again? And as there, I said, but if I can barely afford my rent, I can barely afford food, what am I going to start university? And he said to me, the same trust that you had when you were growing up, when you were in elementary school, for those overseas, but we call it primary school here in Jamaica, that same trust that you had in your parent, which would be my aunt, mm-hmm. my auntie, mommy, that's the same level of trust that I want you to have in me. I am going to pay your school fee.
Mm.
And I'm like, okay, because I have the evidence already. He has done it so many times with the rent and with the moving. And I'm like, okay, Lord, whatever you say. So I'm on campus, and whenever people say to me, you owe school fee, I'm like, there's a balance up there, but I don't know. I'm not perturbed by it. I know it's going to be cleared by exam because God promises that he's going to pay my school fee. So I'm not worried about it any at all. And maybe for the first, I'm just nonchalant about it because I'm like, God is going to take care of that. And let me tell you, you see, God, sometimes we expect that he's going to open up heaven and whatever we need is going to drop from heaven. It's not that he's not able to do it, but he uses our fellow human beings to help us. And it's not like God is going to send you to say, go and beg. God don't send us to beg anybody, because if God sends us to somebody, he would have already prepared their heart for us. So we go and we ask if it is that God lead us to ask somebody for something, ask, because then God sometimes is trying to transform our character. So with the whole, maybe we need some humility. So he says, go and ask Jane. You go up your prayer, say, Lord, I have this need, which he already knows, but he's your friend. So you're going, your dialogue with him, and you express a need, and he says, go to Jane. And you go to Jane and say, Jane, I have this need. No, be mindful that Jane also has the freedom of choice whether she wants to listen to the Holy Spirit or not. But if Jane refuses to be used by him, God is able to use other people. And sometimes our timing is right now. God needs to do it right now. But he's saying, listen, I want to build your faith. So I may be 3 days late. I may be a month late, but I'm always on time. And so I've learned to trust God that even with the housing market going up, because I don't have a house as yet. As I say, I'm a first-year student. Sometimes I don't know. It's only by the grace of God I get by and get through school, and I just give God thanks. He provided a place for me to live now, and I'm just saying, like, you know, to everybody that God can do exceedingly abundantly above all that you could ever ask or even imagine. And don't limit him. So some people will say, God, me just want one little something. Just give me a little, and that's what you're looking for. But try him. Try him. You know? Try him. Right. Say, you want a two-bedroom? I want a two-bedroom. Yes, because at one point when I was looking somewhere to rent, I remember I said to God, I said, God, I want a one-bedroom apartment with a little area that I can have, like, a living room, a kitchen. I want a washroom to be fully grilled. I want this type of windows, and I want the type of tiling that I want, and it is not the small one, but I want the big tiles. Ellie,
okay.
Davis,
yeah,
God, that house, that house was in a corner, literally in plain sight, and nobody rented that house. I was the first person to rent that house. God gifted me that house. When I went and I looked at that house, I called my best friend and I said to her, Joe, listen, it's like God just answered the prayer. And I was up and down looking for places, you know, and this was like next door to me, and I did not see this place. Fully grilled, one bedroom, closet, nice bathroom, because I asked God for all of those things, nice bathroom, a washroom area. I got all of that. So even during the pandemic, there were the different times that persons would call me and say they want the hair to be done. I had a back veranda to, and I was able to do the hair around here. And so God, listen, God is able to do more than we could ever ask or even imagine. And it doesn't matter what, even in these harsh economic times, God is able to do a lot.
Apparently so. Like I said, when I ran across your video on YouTube last Sunday, as a matter of fact, I had run across other videos like that, but I didn't really watch them. And then I said, oh, this keeps on popping up. These kind of videos keep popping up in my newsfeed Sunday mornings or whatever. So I clicked on yours and was really motivated. By the testimony. So that's why I reached out to you. Now, in Jamaica, is living in a rural area less expensive?
Yes, living in a rural area is less expensive. Some persons in a rural area, because they are used to town, so they'll have town prices. But most of the time, it's more affordable than...
Okay. Now, Jamaicans, I mean, the ones I've talked to in the past, some, when they might go to a rural area and they'll build a house, but because a lot of them don't want to have a mortgage on it. I don't know how that runs down there, but they'll build, you know, they'll build it by parts when they have the money, so that way they don't have a mortgage. So explain that culture to us.
All right, so most of the times, like, people, like, you have family, and family will give you land, so that's your inheritance, or you'll buy a piece of land. So what some persons do, because especially if they are paying, hold on, especially if they are paying rent, what they'll do, they'll build, like, the first floor. And even if it has no windows, they may put plyboard, and they live there. And so they don't. So as they work, and what we do, we have something called partnership. They call it partner. So where you deposit a certain amount of money, whether it's per week or per fortnight, and at a certain time, you will get your draw. And so they'll use that lump sum to finish a part of the house. And they'll do it over a period of time until that house is complete. And that belongs to you. You owe nothing to anyone unless you decided to borrow money from a financial institution.
I like that free. I don't want to borrow any money like that. Well, that means I got to, like, it's time for me to make a trip down. Because I'm in Central Florida right now.
Mm-hmm.
So about 45 minutes away from Orlando, middle of the state. So. They're barely, I mean, Jamaica's Cuba's only 90 miles. Anyways, from what I've told, like when you're flying from Florida to Jamaica, it's just like when the plane's getting ready to get set level off, it's time to land. So it's not a long flight. It's not a long flight.
And I think you should come, because if you come here, we are so warm and open.
Yeah, what you just told me, I'm sold on that, because I want to come down there and see that and learn it and probably do some live streams. Because the Jamaicans, I ran into some Jamaicans up, this was several years ago, up in Buffalo, New York. They had an operation going. In Buffalo, New York at that time, and this is back in the 90s, you can buy like $500 houses, house for $1,000. We're talking about big houses in decent neighborhoods. And I was doing a radio program up there, so I met the wife and I met the husband, and they were basically buying cheap houses, renovating them and renting them out, a combination of renting them out and then selling them too. But every person that worked on those houses with them, they flew them in. They were family members and or friends of the family from Jamaica. They didn't use any Americans. They were very nice to me. But I was impressed by that. I said, anyway, you done sold me. I got to come.
And then this is what happens to Ellie Davis. So if Jamaica, they travel abroad and they work. And while they're working, they're here building. They're building in Jamaica. And oftentimes after building, what they will do is rent out maybe the bottom floor and then use that bottom floor. If they took out a mortgage or something, they'll use that the rent to cover the mortgage at the end of the month.
I love that thinking. Love it. Well, that's why the original, we've been doing this podcast for like 10 consecutive years here on Blog Talk. And originally the name of the podcast was It's My House, but then I switched it over last year because our birthday is December the 24th, to BIY Shacks, which means build it yourself. Mm-hmm. Cut out the bank, cut out the government, build it yourself. Just like you said, that the example that you just gave, get together with some friends or relatives or what have you, and you guys build it yourself. So that's what we changed it to. Then I found out like 24% of the planet, soon to be 25% of the planet, they build their own homes. I start my day Monday through Friday. There is on YouTube, there is a FM station. I guess it's in Kingston. Tawna Thomas, she's just one of the broadcasts. Anyway, it's a radio station that they do live streams on YouTube. So I typically pop in for about 10, 15 minutes Monday through Friday. Mm-hmm. But they're on 7 days a week. I really like that. Now, Church Sister, you've got these social media net channels and whatnot. How can people get in touch with you and support what you do as well?
Okay, so persons, if you want to get in touch with me, I'm on Instagram at Diary of a Church Sister. That's C-H-U-R-C-H-S-T-I-S-I-S-T-A. That's C-H-U-R-C-H-S-I-S-T-A. So it's not E-R, but an A. On YouTube, Facebook, and on Instagram, so you can shoot me a message there. For persons who want to reach out to me directly, you can reach out to me on WhatsApp at 547-4658. That's 876-547-4658. You can connect with me there, or you can send me an email at diaryofachurchsister@gmail.com. And so you can connect with me and I can tell you how you can support what I do, or you can support the channel, or you can support me personally. Yeah.
Okay, well, supporter people, I got her locked into my phone because, like I said, her YouTube channel, I don't know how many times I watched that video before I contacted you, but it was very uplifting. And there are other videos, too. It's not just one. She has other videos, too. So that's the wonder of now, Church Sister, do you have any special events, like, during the week or month that you want to promote?
Oh, yes. At the end of, the second week of March, I will be doing a Zoom meeting on how to care for yourself as a church sister. And I mean, males can come as well, talking about everything that has to do with health, mental health, physical health, how to take care of the body, how to take care of your hair, and just talking about different things, sharing different faith-based testimonies as to how God has come through for me. And I also have a church sister WhatsApp support group on WhatsApp. That's the same, 876-547-4658. So if you'd like to be a part of that support group, you can just reach out to me. Just shoot me a message and I will just add you to that group. So each week we do like prayers.
Well,
add
me in.
We hear testimonies and we talk about real life things. So we talk about dating, we talk about the different things that we're going through, we talk about our healing journey, because the aim of this thing, you know, is to heal. Sometimes I believe that church folks put on this facade and we pretend like everything is okay, but come on, we know that everything is not okay. So this is a space for you to be authentic, just to be you, and just to know that this is a non-judgmental space. Whatever, if you're struggling with something, you're rejoicing about something, we're here to rejoice with you, celebrate your birthday, whatever celebration, and just to provide support for church sisters. I am a co-author of a book. It's called Come See a Man. I partnered with Joanna Daniels and some other ladies. We wrote that book where we share a bit of our stories as to how we're overcoming the effects of childhood trauma. Also, I emailed my transcript to an editor. So my editor has my transcript. She's editing it right now. And so my book will be out in short order. Yeah. And I also have a Hey Sis, Write Your Prayers, Prayer Journal. It has diary prompts, daily prompts, just Dear God, because I believe it gives you space to talk to God about whatever you want to talk to him about. He's our father, friend, he's our confidant. So, yeah, that's on Amazon as well.
Okay. Church sister, tell us about this is in the United States, is Black History Month. And Jamaica has an interesting three of black folk, particularly one person in particular, the person they call Queen Nanny. Could you share with us something about her?
What they call her?
Queen Nanny. I think she's on your currency down there.
Oh, Nanny of the Maroons.
That's it, Nanny of the Maroons. That's her.
Oh, she is the only. She's the only female heroine, basically the only female hero that we have here in Jamaica. She is. She was an 18th century leader of Jamaica, the Jamaican Maroon, and they're still active. So we have Maroon Town, Acompong Town. She was a leader in the 18th century. Also, she was a brave woman. She fought for her people, and she stood up to the British authorities. She stood against them because purpose in her heart, and she knew that she wanted freedom for her people, and so she stood up for them. And look at us now. We are free. They have their own. It's almost like they are, though they are within Jamaica, it's almost like they are a state for themselves, by themselves, even though they are here in Jamaica. So if a person can visit Maroon Town, but they will have to, it's almost like you have to send, get in contact with the leader of the Maroon and get permission to visit that part of Jamaica.
Okay, Maroon Town. Well, that's the first time of me hearing about that, because I like discovering what I call historic black townships. So I'll look them up. And, well, that's another reason for me to make a trip down to Jamaica. Well, Quinn, Church Sister, thank you a lot for coming on with us today. And I'll be in touch with you on the regular. And on that note, we're going to wrap it up for today. Everyone have a good rest of the day and great weekend.
Okay, thank you very much.